Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 6th of December. It's a very interesting project that's underway that is looking at the presidential recordings, FDR, Truman, Eisenhower, JFK, LBJ, and Nixon, recordings that were secret, 5,000 hours of meetings that they had with important people about, for the most part, fairly important topics. Our guest this hour, in addition to some of the recordings we'll be hearing from Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, Mark Silverstone, Assistant Director for Presidential Studies and Associate Professor with the Presidential Recordings Program. He coordinates the work of this program and the Presidential Oral History Program. His work focuses on the recordings of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, with a special emphasis on their foreign policy, particularly that involving Vietnam. He is part of the team of scholars transcribing and editing the secret White House tapes. He also directs the Digital Classroom Initiative, which is a teacher-dedicated portal seeking to help secondary school teachers incorporate material from this program into their learning activities. He's located at the University of Virginia. And what a great way to learn about all of this, to incorporate it in your history classes. I think it would be great. We're going to hear quite a few of the recordings during the course of this hour, and welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Mark Silverstone, thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Give me a little background. How did you discover that there were all these recordings, and how far back it went in history?
I guess I had found out about them like most other Americans had found out about them during the course of the 1990s, particularly after the after Congress mandated a review of all records that related to the Kennedy assassination. The White House tapes that had been secret for quite a while became more public in droves. We had known about them certainly since 1973, after it had been disclosed at the Senate Watergate hearings that Nixon had taped, and all Americans had found out about them at that point. I was a little young and not quite politically conscious at the moment, but certainly as I got older and then became more interested in history myself, the tapes became a source of great fascination. And then in 2000, I found myself in a position to be able to work on them, and it's been an incredible 10 years spending time with LBJ and JFK in the Oval Office.
I would imagine some of these just really do bring history to life in such an extraordinary way. It's, you feel like you're an insider on a conversation. You shouldn't quite be there, but you're so happy you are.
It is. I noted that at the outset you had mentioned how valuable this is for students, and I can't stress that enough. There's just no way that you can come away from listening to Lyndon Johnson and not know who Lyndon Johnson is after that. There's such an immediacy in being able to use the tapes, particularly in a classroom setting. Students get to understand who the person is, who the president is, on a much more personal, human level. And scholars do, too. I mean, when we have a chance to listen to the tapes roll as the presidents move from one topic to another quite quickly, you get a much better sense, although we had had it before, a much more immediate sense of how much is on the president's plate at any one time and how quickly they have to move, again, from one subject to another.
Let's hear one of the tapes. We'll start with just a short portion of a conversation that President Kennedy had with his doctor. Do you want to give us a little background on this? We know now that he suffered from horrible health from the time that he was really a very young guy, and had Addison's disease. This is a conversation. What should we listen for as he's talking with White House physician Admiral George Berkeley?
This is a conversation from March of 1963, and I believe it's the only such conversation that we have of Kennedy actually ordering some medication, but I imagine it's a conversation that he had had frequently with his doctors in the White House. As you note, Kennedy had been sick at a very young age and had suffered chronic back pain for quite a while. Bob Dalek, who I believe you had on your show a while ago,
yes, we did,
done more than anybody in disclosing the extent of Kennedy's infirmities and how much pain he must have been in while president. It's really quite an extraordinary story, and he was medicated constantly. And this clip is just one instance of Kennedy asking for one of these little blue pills, I believe. We've tried to ascertain what that blue pill is, but up to now our efforts have been inconclusive. But it is a snapshot into the more personal side of President John F. Kennedy.
Let's listen.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Board.
Dr. Berkley. Oh, doctor, I wonder if you could send up a little extra medication.
I gave it to Mrs. Lincoln.
Did you get extra?
Yeah, she has it on her desk.
I see.
We can get it up to you, up to your quarters?
No, I'm in my office. Has she got it?
Yes, she has.
What about one of those blue pills?
Oh, we can give that to her.
Okay.
She doesn't have that. I'll bring it right up.
One of those blue pills.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting why that particular conversation is on tape, because Kennedy had the ability to tape the conversations that he wanted to tape, particularly as he could signal his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, who's mentioned in the tape, to record conversations that he'd had on his phone. And it's not entirely clear why this particular conversation was recorded. Might have been that it was a holdover from a previous conversation, and either Kennedy had not signaled to stop recording or Lincoln had just let the machine run. That's to distinguish, in some ways, Kennedy's recording technique and style from not so much Lyndon Johnson's, but certainly from Richard Nixon's, whose recording apparatus was voice-activated so that anything that Nixon had said in various rooms in which he was working was recorded. The value of the Kennedy system, being it manually operated, both for telephone as well as for the meetings, is that we have some kind of a sense of what Kennedy himself thought was important. So we can trace the subjects that he's important, that he's recording, and surmise as to the level of their importance throughout the course of not his thousand days, since he began taping in the middle of 62, but the second half of his presidency, at least.
What were your thoughts about the way that both of these presidents operated, their style in the presidency, from listening to them so often? Was Johnson, as we have heard, a pretty vulgar guy? Was he really caring about the issues that became a part of his presidency, particularly civil rights? Did he feel it in his soul? What did Kennedy feel in his soul?
You know, that's a great question. They're different on tape, and part of that stems from the kind of taping that they engaged in. Johnson was taping primarily telephone conversations. The vast majority of Johnson tapes are telephone conversations, and again, conversations that he had directed his secretaries to tape and then ultimately to transcribe while he was in office. There are relatively few meeting tapes that Johnson recorded from 1968, and those deal primarily with Vietnam and thought about peace, his thoughts about peace negotiations. Kennedy, on the other hand, was taping primarily meetings. Meetings in the Oval Office, meetings in the Cabinet Room, and comparatively fewer telephone conversations. Now, that said, yes, when you're listening to LBJ, you certainly get that image of Johnson as a larger-than-life figure, profane at times, bright as can be, and yes, committed and agonizing over certain issues that faced him, particularly over Vietnam. I mean, you can hear it as plain as day that this is a man who is racked with anxiety about the decisions that he faces. Kennedy on the tapes, in some ways, particularly on the tapes that we've listened to, and I should point out that the transcriptions that we've made of the Kennedy tapes have only taken us really up through the early part of 1963. In many ways, Kennedy is hanging back a little bit. There are passages in the missile crisis tapes where he's much more forceful, but in many cases, he hangs back, he listens, he asks fantastic questions, he probes. And you can tell how quickly his mind is working. Quite often he will start and stop sentences all in one breath. It's a challenge to transcribe in many ways as a result.
I imagine. You have told us to pay particular attention to this. This is a valuable piece of conversation here. It concerns Vietnam and a question that we have had about Kennedy and whether or not he would have changed policy. Can you describe this meeting? It was a briefing by Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Maxwell Taylor, on their trip to Vietnam. And Kennedy is questioning, I believe, the wisdom of committing his administration to a troop withdrawal.
Yeah, this is something that Kennedy had been concerned about, actually, for some time. Planning for a withdrawal from Vietnam had actually begun in the summer of 1962, when Secretary McNamara directed that such planning begin. It wasn't until January of 63 that an initial plan was drawn up. It was revised over the course of 1963, and then over the course of that summer, as the Buddhist disturbances became more dramatic and more of a problem for the Kennedy administration, Diem declared martial law in August of 63. Kennedy sends over a couple of fact-finding teams to figure out what's really going on there. What can we do to get Diem to reform, to govern the way that we feel he needs to govern in order to prosecute the counterinsurgency correctly? At the tail end of September, McNamara and Maxwell Taylor go over, and they bring back to Kennedy this report essentially to get the United States out of Vietnam. There are certain things that need to be done at the moment to put pressure on Diem as a lever to induce certain reforms. But in the end, as McNamara will say, we need to be looking at a program where we can essentially get out after 3 years' time. This is not a situation where we can be there indefinitely. There has to be some kind of an end date. And they present this to Kennedy in October of 1963, and we are extremely fortunate that that meeting was taped.
Here it is.
Do you think this 1,000 reduction can really, is that going to be an assumption that it's going well, and if it doesn't go well?
No, sir. One of the major terms, two major terms we have. First, I believe we can complete the military campaign in the first three quarters of 64. Second, it extends beyond that period. We believe we can train the Vietnamese to take over the essential functions and withdraw the bulk of our forces. And this 1,000 is in conjunction with that. I have a list of the units here that are represented by that. We need a way to get out of Vietnam. This is what they're doing. And to leave forces there when they're not needed, I think, is wasteful and complicates both their problems and ours. Exposure of U.S. combat personnel to the
the guerrilla actions in South Vietnam, actions of the people of South Vietnam, should gradually develop a capability to suppress themselves. And I think this will be of great value to us in meeting the very strong views of Fulbright and others that we're bogged down in Asia and will be there protecting.
It's a very interesting conversation.
Yes, it is.
Here's Bob McNamara giving John Kennedy, the consummate politician, political advice on what to do about Vietnam. And some have wondered, some scholars have wondered what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some play acting involved? Did Kennedy and McNamara work this out ahead of time so that McNamara would seem to be the one who's in some ways the dove and give Kennedy some cover internally, and then Kennedy essentially endorse McNamara's and Taylor's recommendations? Was Kennedy fully committed to this idea of getting out of Vietnam all along? My sense is that it was an aspiration that he had, and that's the way that I would come down on it. It's an aspiration that he had to remove U.S. troops from Vietnam, but that he was not prepared to do so if the military situation looked unpromising.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a whole other conversation. But this tape that we have is certainly very important for having that conversation.
And then you think about how badly it did go, as they suggest. If this goes badly, ooh, did it ever go badly?
Yeah, it went horribly. And there's even, there's another clip that we have of Kennedy, a month or so later, reflecting on the Diem assassination and the problems that showed up in his own policymaking. As a result of that assassination, there really was no more political stability within Vietnam for the remainder of the war. I think the Kennedy team recognized that there would be some of that following an ouster of Diem, whether Diem was killed or not. That event proved the touchstone, particularly for Lyndon Johnson, who later would severely criticize the Kennedy administration for the coup and also for the assassination. And Johnson would come back to that again and again. And we even have that on tape, a conversation where LBJ is talking to Gene McCarthy in early 1966, right around the time of the Fulbright hearings. And criticizing the Kennedy administration, that the Diem assassination was really the turning point. We've had no stability since then, and this is essentially what Kennedy has left us with.
Hmm. We welcome phone calls for our guest, and here's how you reach our conversation this morning. Our guest is Mark Silverstone, Assistant Director for Presidential Studies and Associate Professor with the Presidential Recordings Program at the University of Virginia. He coordinates the work of the Presidential Recordings Program, and he has a special interest in the recordings of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, and then specifically the foreign relations deliberations that those two presidents had. But these recordings go back to FDR, include FDR, Truman, Eisenhower, JFK, LBJ, and Nixon. And they're extraordinary. You can just spend days listening to these. Many of them are on the web right now. We'll give you that information so that you can listen to what they've already poured through, and they have miles to go before they put this one to bed. Let's welcome phone calls momentarily. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we welcome a few phone calls now. Richard from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Just when I was calling in, I understand that your guest mentioned the assassination of Diem.
Yes.
Of course, I've always regarded the American government as being closely involved in that enterprise, and I would offer the opinion that once we traveled down that path, we had made the decision to escalate in Vietnam. I'd like your guest's opinion about that point.
Thanks, Richard. Kennedy actually takes responsibility for the coup, if not the assassination of Diem, although various scholars have pointed out that Kennedy certainly should have been aware that in any coup, Diem likely would have been murdered, and he was, along with his brother, Ngo Dinh Nu. The escalation itself, you could certainly point to John F. Kennedy as being the father of American escalation in Vietnam. When Kennedy came into the Oval Office, there were fewer than 700 U.S. military advisors in South Vietnam, and when he left, there were about 16,500. And some people do consider that escalation. There are other scholars who would note that those soldiers were providing assistance to the South Vietnamese armed forces, and that you really get escalation with Lyndon Johnson, particularly in 1965, in the summer of 1965, when Johnson decides that American troops are essentially going to have to take over the fighting from the South Vietnamese. And so we move from roughly 80,000 U.S. forces committed in the summer of 1965 to 184,000 by December of 1965. That's usually the point at which we talk about escalation, but you're absolutely right that Kennedy expanded the American commitment. He made it much deeper for the United States to get out. It would have been difficult for Kennedy himself to get out had he been elected to a second term. And those who would posit that Kennedy would get out all note that he would not have done so prior to 1964, really. The election would come, and then he'd have the political capital to do so, capital that Hubert Humphrey, as vice president, suggested that LBJ himself had. But escalation, certainly an expanded commitment, yeah, that came with John Kennedy.
Thanks, Richard. George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi, yeah. A couple questions regarding Kennedy, especially. Is there anything that you've heard that shows that he acknowledges that there really was not a missile gap between the United States and the Soviet Union? If there was a missile gap, it was actually in America's favor, and that he actually used this to help himself get elected? And the other question had to do about Vietnam. Was there any acknowledgement on his part that the United States basically split the country apart and did not allow an election for the entire Vietnam in 1954 because they knew that the communists would win?
Yeah, I'll take the second one first. I haven't heard anything that Kennedy said about that earlier history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Kennedy had gone there in 1951. He was very critical of the way that Eisenhower was handling the war. He supported moves toward South Vietnamese independence, did not like the military gloss that the Eisenhower administration was putting on it with its aid to France. But there's nothing on the tapes that I have heard that alludes to Kennedy talking much about that earlier history. And Kennedy, in fact, doesn't really even start talking about Vietnam really until well into 1963. He begins taping in July of 62. There's one conversation on Vietnam in the summer of 62. There's a little bit in early January 63 when a particular battle goes very badly. There's another one in May of 63, but then he really starts to tape in August. And again, given Kennedy's control over the system, we suspect that this is the point that John Kennedy became really engaged in Vietnam, and it's an insight into his policy-making style on that issue. Regarding the missile gap, same thing. I haven't heard anything on the tapes suggesting that they were wrong to note a missile gap, or at least to note that missile gap was in Russia's favor, as it was in America's favor. At the point that he was claiming it during the campaign and then certainly thereafter.
Hmm. Anything else, George?
No, that's it. It's just kind of interesting, I think, that some rather important kinds of issues like this oftentimes just kind of like they don't get enough attention
right.
as things come to light.
Yeah, well, you'll love listening to these tapes, George. You can't stop yourself, can you, Mark? You just want to keep going. Oh my gosh, this is so fascinating.
Yeah, and you can dabble in really all of them, in the foreign policy, the domestic, the personal. There are
yes.
lots of tapes. I think you'd mentioned at the outset that we had created a portal specifically for teachers. And what we tried to do was to break the conversations up by topical area, so that if a teacher is teaching on Freedom Summer, let's say, 64, there are a bunch of tapes that the teacher can go to use for that. Or
right.
Or is teaching on technology, there are tapes on Kennedy and space, which are quite interesting. There's a whole bunch of other tapes, though, that we really did not know what to do with, particularly the tape with Kennedy ordering the blue pills, or Johnson talking about his need for a new pair of slacks. So we threw that into kind of a grab bag, President's the Human Dimension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been reading over the weekend some of, actually we have a lot of impressive people this week, you included. We're speaking with David Eisenhower on Wednesday, and I was reading some of his book about his grandfather. And I was amazed. I just had never thought of this before, that there was no love lost between the Eisenhower administration and the Kennedy administration. They didn't think very highly of Kennedy and vice versa.
Yeah, I think that is true at the outset, although my understanding is that Ike did come to an appreciation of Kennedy, certainly of his political ability, but also of his intellect. And and what might have been fairly sour early on mellowed a little bit over the course of time. There's even a great conversation that Kennedy has with Eisenhower during the height of the missile crisis. Kennedy is about to go on TV and tell the American public that the United States is going to place a quarantine around Cuba. And there's a conversation from earlier that morning in which Kennedy and Ike talk about what this all means. And Kennedy had placed calls to Harry Truman as well. It's one of the few times that we have presidents speaking to one another, and we can listen in and hear what that's all about. Hardly anybody knew what it was like to be president at that time, and they shared a very particular spot, understanding responsibility as most not anybody really else could.
Yeah. He describes, David does, a time that Kennedy reached out to Eisenhower and they met at Camp David because Kennedy was really upset about what happened with the invasion of Cuba. And Eisenhower thought that he had dismantled some of the security apparatus in the White House. And so he was upset with Kennedy, but he felt that, hey, I have a chance to tell him this is what you did wrong here, and that he asked for it. You know, he took the advice willingly.
Right. And that's, I think, a testament to John Kennedy,
right,
who was very comfortable in his own skin.
Mm-hmm.
He was very comfortable sitting around a group of advisors who would not agree with him. In fact, there is that famous scene from the missile crisis. It's been popularized in movies such as 13 Days, in the docudrama that was on TV back in the 70s, The Missiles of October, in which Kennedy believes that the right move to get out of the missile crisis in Broglio is to make a trade, essentially, of NATO missiles, particularly in Turkey, for Soviet missiles in Cuba, and Kennedy's advisors reject that. We have it on tape, with them saying, we have to tell you, Mr. President, we understand that this is your desire, but we all want you to know that we don't think this is the right move. But the voice that really mattered was Kennedy's.
Yeah.
And he was comfortable in that.
Let's listen to one more clip before we move to Johnson. One of the big deals of the 1960s, I never understood the genesis of this idea, was to go to the moon within the decade. And this particular clip looks at the U.S. space program and Kennedy's thoughts about the moon. Set it up for us, please, sir.
Sure. This is, interestingly enough, just after the missile crisis itself had been concluded. We usually think about the missile crisis as the 13 days, and that's true, bringing it to the end of October of 62. But the crisis continues because the United States still needs to make sure that all of the weapons are off the island, that all of the delivery systems are off the island, and even Soviet troops are off the island. So for several weeks, there are negotiations going back and forth about how to verify what Khrushchev has agreed to do. Right after Kennedy makes the announcement that essentially the crisis is over on the 20th of November, he has a conversation with his key people from NASA over what to do about the space program. And what prompts this is that Brainerd Holmes, who is the head of manned space, who is essentially directing the lunar landing at NASA, believes that the program is slipping. It's falling behind. Not enough money has been devoted to it, and he wants a supplemental appropriation. Others within NASA have resisted this, and Holmes himself has a contact at Time magazine. So he has decided to go ahead and leak this information in order to try to force Kennedy's hand to deal with it and appropriate that money. Kennedy finds out about it. He calls a meeting between Jim Webb, who's the administrator of NASA, Webb's deputy, Bob Siemens, and Brainerd Holmes, head of manned space travel. And they talk about what should be done with the lunar program, and it's fascinating for a couple of reasons. One, here's Jim Webb, who had been around the block once or twice. He had been director of the budget under Harry Truman, had been an undersecretary of state in the Truman administration, and he goes toe-to-toe with John Kennedy in a way that I hadn't heard any other figure do. You also hear Kennedy, who we know as being the proponent of this idea to go to the moon, makes a famous address in May of 1961. Here he is talking about maybe not so interested in space. There are a lot of things he's interested in, but this may not rise to the top of his list. It's a fascinating window into what he thinks the lunar landing is all about, and what it's all about is the Cold War. It's about the competition with the Soviet Union. Being second to the moon is like being second anytime. And it's a remark that's pure Kennedy, given Kennedy's competitive fires. But interestingly, that line comes directly from Lyndon Johnson, because it was Johnson who recommended to Kennedy in April of 61 that this is where the United States should put its energies regarding NASA.
And here it is.
Do you put this program, do you think this program is the top priority program of the agency?
No, sir, I do not. I think it is one of the top priority programs, but I think it's very important to recognize here that as you have found what you could do with the rocket, as you found how you could get it beyond the Earth's atmosphere and into space and make measurements, several scientific disciplines that are very powerful have begun to converge on this area.
Jim, I think it is the top priority. I think we ought to have that very clear. Some of these other programs can slip 6 months or 9 months and nothing is going to happen. It's going to make, but this is important for political reasons, international political reasons, and this is, whether we like it or not, an essential race. If we get second to the moon, it's nice, but it's like being second anytime. So that if we're second by 6 months, because we didn't give it the kind of priority, then of course that'd be very serious. So I think we have to take the view this is the top priority of it. I said,
but the environment of space is where you're going to operate the Apollo and where you're going to do the landing.
I know all these other things and the satellite, the communications and weather and all. They're desirable, but they can wait for
I'm not putting those. I'm talking there about the scientific program to understand the space environment within which you've got to fly Apollo and make a landing on the moon.
Is that saying that the lunar program, the land, the man, and the moon, is the top priority of the agency?
Science that goes with it.
Well, if you add that.
No, but I mean, the science
that is necessary.
The science, going to the moon is a top priority project. Now, there are a lot of related scientific information and developments that will come from that, which are important. But the whole thrust of the agency, in my opinion, is the lunar program. The rest of it can wait 6 or 9 months.
Well, the trouble that Jerry pulled up his hand, let me say one thing, and then maybe you want to reinforce it. The thing that that troubles me here about making such a flat statement as that is, number one, there are real unknowns as to whether man can live under the weightless condition and you'll ever make the lunar landing. This is one kind of political vulnerability I'd like to avoid such a flat commitment to. If you say you fail on your number one priority, this is something to think about. Now, the second point is that as we can go out and make measurements in space by being physically able to get...
Well, that was a lively conversation, wasn't it? Did he normally like to have people that energized and tell him exactly what they thought?
That's my sense. I mean, he was, again, he's very comfortable having frank conversation. He wanted his meetings to be run like that, compared to Lyndon Johnson, particularly on Vietnam, who wanted a consensus already arrived at before the meeting took place. And it was a problem with Johnson's policymaking on Vietnam, but Kennedy appreciated that roundtable atmosphere in which everybody got a chance to say what was on their mind.
Hmm. Let's go to a phone call. Matthew in Elgin, Illinois. Hi, Matthew.
Well, hi. I'm enjoying the program. I try to stay out of politics quite a bit lately, but just in the past, current issue of Time Magazine is the death of the founder of the Libertarian Party. His impetus for doing that was something that gave a lot of people impetus in that direction, was wage and price controls. I believe, you don't happen to know the date off the top of your head, was it August 16th, 1971, Richard Nixon?
That sounds about right.
Okay, and are there any tapes regarding that?
There most likely are. Nixon began taping in February of 71, and virtually everything that Nixon said in a number of locales, be it the Oval Office, be it the Cabinet Room, be it presidential living quarters, be it Camp David, several rooms, be it his hideaway in the old Executive Office Building, were taped. Certainly our resident expert in Nixon, Ken Hughes, would be the authority on that.
Hmm. We should tell people where they can find these tapes, too. I don't want to leave them at the end of the show saying, oh, I want to hear more.
Sure. There's a couple places you can go. First off, if listeners went to the Miller Center website at millercenter.org, they could navigate to the Presidential Recordings Program. That's the name of my program here. Kind of a quick and easy way to get right to the tapes, though, is at whitehousetapes.net.
Great.
It will bring you to a page of the PRP, and you can scroll down for the transcript and audio clips. One of the things we created to try to make these materials more accessible to people is to present the transcript in a way that scrolls along with the audio, so you can listen and read at the same time.
Yes, it's very helpful.
Yeah, it was a brainchild of David Coleman, who chairs the Presidential Recordings Program, and it's worked out very well. So whitehousetapes.net is probably the most direct way to get there.
Great. We'll welcome more phone calls and hear more tapes. The next tape that we will hear is a very, it's kind of bizarre, the call between Jackie Kennedy and LBJ 10 days after President Kennedy's assassination. And we'll also hear a remarkable conversation that President Johnson had with Dr. Martin Luther King about how important it was for Johnson to be in touch and to have King's ideas brought to him, to Johnson. So that's coming up. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Mark Silverstone. He coordinates the work of the Presidential Recordings Program and the Presidential Oral History Program. Wouldn't that be a fun job to have? You have to be a history professor as well, but to listen to these recordings and get to know these people in a fairly profound way would be wonderful. And again, he said, go to whitehousetapes.net and you can not only get Kennedy and Johnson, that's his special area, but these tapes go back to FDR. So it's a wealth of information. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Want to let you know about a couple shows coming up. Tomorrow, Matt Taibbi, who had the flu last week when he was supposed to be with us, is over the flu. And he is one heck of a writer. He didn't know very much about what was going on Wall Street, the financial industry collapse. He found out and then some about what went on. And he's written a book, Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and the Long Con That Is Breaking America. He will be with us tomorrow at 10. Wednesday, it will be David Eisenhower talking about his grandfather. And Thursday, Walter Mondale will be with us. So a pretty good lineup for the week, I would say. Our phone number, if you'd like to join this conversation, 800-486-8655. We'll move to Lyndon Johnson now and start with this phone call between Jackie Kennedy and LBJ 10 days after the Kennedy assassination. I was alive during that time. I remember those days that we all just watched television. We watched television and cried.
Yeah, I was alive too, but only 1 year old. But certainly I've heard about it from my folks, having a chance to listen to the tapes has certainly given me a more visceral understanding of what that period is like. And that's what the tapes provide. It's that kind of affective component to history that is somewhat accessible in writing. Certainly when there's good writing, you feel that. But having a chance to listen to people's voices and hear the emotion in their voice makes a world of difference. And in the clip that you're speaking about now, the LBJ Jackie clip, you're right, it's 10 days after the assassination, and it's Johnson speaking to the late president's widow, in a way that, you know, some would describe as being one of the forms of the Johnson treatment, when he was trying to perhaps butter somebody up, recognizing that he may need to use them later on in a certain way. And here's LBJ as the caretaker president, recognizing that he has to continue Kennedy's policies, essentially. Certainly, he was not the front runner on the ticket, and he was brought in only really because he could get the Southern votes and the Texas votes, but he's thrust into the presidency. His whole approach now is continuing the Kennedy policy and Kennedy's policies and programs, and to do that especially, he needs the Kennedy team on board. So he'll retain a lot of Kennedy's advisors, and he particularly needs Jackie. And he'll need Jackie going through 1964 as he's mounting his own campaign for the White House. This conversation is a snapshot into their relationship, which was certainly amicable. But it's Johnson recognizing that he's going to need Jackie also later on.
Mr. President?
I just wanted you to know you were loved and by so many and so much.
Oh, Mr.
I'm
President,
one of them.
I tried. I didn't dare bother you again, but I got Kenny O'Donnell over here to give you a message. If he ever saw you, did he give it to you yet?
No.
About my letter?
No.
That was waiting for me last night?
Listen, sweetie, now, first thing you got to learn. You got some things to learn, and one of them is that you don't bother me. You give me strength.
But I wasn't going to send you in one more letter, and I was
just
scared you'd
answer. Don't send me anything. You just come over and put your arm around me. That's all you do. When you haven't got anything else to do, let's take a walk. Let's walk around the backyard and just let me tell you how much you mean to all of us and how we can carry on if you give us a little strength.
But you know what I wanted to say to you about that letter? I know how rare a letter is in a president's handwriting. Do you know that I've got more in your handwriting than I do in Jack now?
Oh, what? Well.
And for you to write it at this time and then to send me that thing today of, you know, your tape announcement and everything.
I want you to just know this, that I told my mama a long time ago when everybody else gave up about my election in 48.
Yeah.
My mother and my wife and my sisters and you females got a lot of courage that we men don't have. And so we have to rely on you and depend on you, and you got something to do. You got the president relying on you, and this is not the first thing you have. So there are not many women, you know, run around with a good many presidents. So you just bear that in mind. You got the biggest job of your life.
He ran around with two presidents. That's what they'll say about me. Okay, anytime.
Goodbye, bye.
Thank you for calling, Mr. President.
Bye,
goodbye.
Sweetie. Do come back.
I will.
I don't know. There's something about that one that just is... It doesn't linger the right way with me.
Yeah.
You know?
You're not alone in feeling that way.
Okay.
That's often the response that we get when we play that conversation. Of course, Jackie's voice, I hadn't been exposed to it that much, and the first time I'd heard it, there was only one person it reminded me of.
Marilyn Monroe?
Absolutely.
Yes, yes.
And again, that's the reaction that most most people have. Johnson, in many ways, what he says in that conversation about relying on the women standing by him, they're the strong ones, he did feel that way in many ways. And he alludes to the 1948 Senate race, in which he barely won by something, by really a handful of votes, and got the name landslide Lyndon as a result. But he did feel that in many ways he needed the support of women, and found their strength to be quite comforting for himself. But the nature of that rapport, the interactions between Lyndon and Mrs. Kennedy there, it's bordering on flirtation, to be sure.
Yes, it sure is.
Yeah.
And for him to bring up the 1948 Senate race, I'm sorry, it was 10 days after the presidential assassination.
Yeah, yes. You might wonder about his tact at that point, and the extent to which Jacqueline Kennedy wanted to hear about that. But he was trying to provide a context, I think, for what he needed from her and what the nation needed from her, quite honestly, because many people felt that their world had crumbled.
Yes.
And it was not just at that point, but going forward, she was the symbol in many ways of that era, an era that she would later characterize as that of Camelot. And the nation was relying on her, much as Lyndon himself needed to rely on her and other women in his life.
And she was extraordinary during that time. There is no doubt about it.
Yeah.
She was one strong woman.
Yeah.
Jamie from Whitefish Bay. Hi. Jamie, are you there?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, I understand that Jackie Kennedy thought that Johnson had something to do with the assassination of her husband, and that Johnson himself thought it was a conspiracy.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about what Jackie had thought regarding Lyndon's culpability in there, but Johnson himself did think there was a conspiracy. He thought about that at the time, in November of 63, and really never wavered from that belief straight up through the end of his life, which is not to say that he didn't believe that Oswald pulled the trigger, but that he didn't necessarily think that Oswald was acting alone. Johnson did think that there was a conspiracy involved.
We have time to hear just one more, and so we won't set this up very carefully, but it's a remarkable conversation that Johnson had just a few days after taking the presidency with Dr. Martin Luther King.
Interest in your cooperation and your communication, and a good many people told me that they heard about your statement, I guess, on TV, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
I've been locked up in this office, and I haven't seen it, but I won't tell you how grateful I am and how worthy I'm going to try to be of all your hopes.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so happy to hear that, and I knew that you had just that great spirit, and you know you have our support and backing.
Well,
because we know what a difficult period this is.
It's just an impossible period. We got a budget coming up that's we got nothing to do with. It's practically already made, and we got a civil rights bill that hadn't even passed the House, and it's November, and Hubert Humphrey told me yesterday everybody wanted to go home. We got a tax bill that they haven't touched, and we just got to not let up on any of them and keep going, and I guess they'll say that I'm repudiated, but I'm going to ask the Congress Wednesday to just stay there, they pass them all. They won't do it, but we'll just keep them there next year till they do, and we just won't give up an inch.
Well, this is mighty fine. I think it's so imperative. I think one of the great tributes that we can pay in memory of President Kennedy is to try to enact some of the great progressive policies that he sought to initiate.
Well, I'm going to support them all, and you can count on that, and I'm going to do my best to get other men to do likewise, and I'll have to have y'all's help. I never needed more than I do now.
Well, you know you have it, and just feel free to call on us for anything.
Thank you so much, Martin.
All right.
Call me when you...
to the family.
I sure will. Call me when you're down here next time.
I certainly will.
But let's get together, and any suggestions you got, bring them in.
Fine. I certainly will do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a conversation that happens fairly close to the assassination, in fact, in which Johnson and King are talking about all that is before Johnson himself in trying to enact the Kennedy agenda on civil rights and tax cut, education, medical aid for the elderly. There is a later conversation that I think you might have mentioned regarding Vietnam, in which Johnson lays out to King his rationale for why the U.S. is in Vietnam and is there to stay, essentially, to win the war. It's an interesting relationship between the two of them. As you can hear, Johnson very much needs Martin
right.
Luther King.
Yeah.
And he needs him through 64 and as well through 65.
Yeah. Oh, I just wish we could talk all day and listen to these. Wouldn't it be fun? It'd be a great way to spend this Monday. Thank you so much for doing this project. It's wonderful to discover it, and I know that many of our listeners, and I will as well, spend a lot of hours listening to these tapes. It's fascinating. Join us again, please.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen. I certainly will.
Okay, thank you. Mark Silverstone. And once again, you can go to the site at whitehousetapes.net. You will find not only Kennedy and Johnson, but many other presidents and recordings that are a real treat to listen to. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour and for doing on-air production.